well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Going guestless, but we're going to be talking about something I actually ran across at the Harvard Kennedy School's website, how understanding the economics of guns can improve public welfare. Yes, a Harvard Kennedy School scholar studying the firearms market in the United States to understand whether regulation can balance the importance of guns to Americans with public health and safety. That the subheadline by Robert O'Neill. First of all, I will say it's kind of interesting to see a Harvard website acknowledge the importance of firearms to millions of Americans. But at the end of the day, this is about coming up with, I don't want to put words in the academics' mouth. And I think that they are trying to deal with some aspects of reality, including the fact that we have the right to keep and bear arms. But again, it is about balancing public safety with that right. And I don't think that's the right approach, because our right to keep and bear arms should not be subject to limitations based on the actions of criminals or those who criminally misuse a firearm. And that, I think, is fundamentally what this is about. So O'Neill talks about a couple of scholars, Luis Armona, who's an assistant professor of public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, who has co-authored two papers on the free market, basically, in firearms. According to O'Neill, he believes a better understanding of the basic economies, basic economics of firearms, why consumers buy them, how manufacturers price them, how regulations like taxes affect the behavior for market participants, will lead to, quote, better policies, reduced violence, and possibly even buy-in from pro-gun interest groups. Now, that was the one that I thought, okay, if you want buy-in from Second Amendment groups, I'm curious. I want to hear what you have to say. So Armona and his co-author on these studies, Adam Rosenberg, who's a doctoral candidate at Stanford, used gun purchase data from Massachusetts, which, as O'Neill says, is one of the very first such data sets to be made publicly available, in combination with other data sets to better understand the legal firearms market. While they did not have identifying data for individuals, they were able to see general characteristics. Firearm buyers, they say, much more likely to be male and live in areas that are more conservative based on voting patterns, more rural, and less racially diverse. The research in that paper measuring the market for firearms, according to O'Neill, quote, helps set the stage for further work by highlighting how primary data sources can shed light on fundamental features of the firearm market. So, you know, it's interesting. We were just talking earlier this week with Nolan Howard, right, from 617 Defense in Boston. Now, according to this data set in Massachusetts, basically a bunch of rural white guys were buying guns in the state. But that's not the only, even if that's true, even if the majority of firearm purchases are guys who live and look like me, that is certainly not the case for every gun owner in the state of Massachusetts, right? There are plenty of women who are buying guns. There are plenty of African Americans who are buying guns. There are plenty of Hispanic Americans who are buying guns. And gun ownership appears to be becoming more diverse across the country. In the wake of Donald Trump's election, there are a lot of folks on the left who are now saying, oh my God, I want a gun. So I don't know what that data set actually tells you. And again, is Massachusetts gun ownership habits typical of gun ownership in the United States, given the restrictions that Massachusetts puts in place? It's a lot easier for somebody who lives in rural Western Massachusetts to acquire a firearm than it is for somebody in Boston, quite frankly. It's cheaper. It's much easier to find the mandated training. There are more gun stores available in these rural areas, per capita anyway, than in Boston, Massachusetts. So I don't know that that data set actually would tell the researchers a whole lot. But in a second research paper, Second Best Amendment, Market Power and Tax Design in the Firearms Industry, Armona and Rosenberg used detailed data on the demand and supply side of the gun market, the characteristics and prices of firearms, micro data from Massachusetts, and aggregate gun sales from other states to understand how regulations would impact consumers and social welfare. Some facts, O'Neill writes, immediately stood out to them. First, the ability to purchase firearms provides a lot of benefit to consumers. And that's interesting, right? Around $18 billion per year, just over 10% of the value to consumers from being able to purchase a new car. Second, there are already more guns in the United States than people. And existing firearms stay in usable condition for many years, which limits the impacts of firearm market regulations on public health outcomes like gun deaths. Unless you buy back all 330 million weapons that are in circulation, you can't influence homicide rates as much as policymakers might like, Armona says. So what those two facts combine to mean is that the trade-off between public health and the immense benefits that consumers receive from being able to buy guns is not trivial. These are similar magnitude objects. So, again, you know, I said at the outset, like, even though I think Armona and his colleague are looking towards more regulation as an answer, he at least is willing to wrestle with some aspects of reality that, quite frankly, most gun control advocates are not, right? We have more guns than people in this country. Unless you find a way to round up all those guns, you're not banning your way to safety. And by putting those regulations in place, by making it harder for people to exercise their right to keep and bear arms, you again are not only impacting their rights, but you are impacting their values. You are impacting their political choices, right? You're making it more likely that they're then going to vote against that party that is stripping them of those rights. Armona went on to say that a lot of people on the left who advocate for further gun regulation believe that we should just ban all guns. He said that would certainly have a sizable impact on firearm homicides and public health, but guns are highly durable and there's a huge stock. So banning the sale of new weapons is not going to make the biggest impact on total deaths and comes with a meaningful harm to consumers. In addition, he says, we know that the political capital to pass large-scale policy affecting firearms is scarce at the national level, in part due to the influence of gun rights advocacy groups. Now, I will say, as much as I appreciate Armona bending to reality to some degree, I can't help but notice that he's not talking about the right to keep and bear arms, right? It's about market forces, about how it impacts consumers, the trade-offs between, you know, large-scale bans of firearms and the political capital is going to be expended. He doesn't really get into the constitutionality of these large-scale bans, which, again, is a huge problem. We have the right to keep and bear arms. So if you want to ban all guns, you're going to have to get rid of that right. And, in fact, not only are you going to have to repeal the Second Amendment at the federal level, you're either going to have to replace it with an amendment that says specifically you do not have the right to own a gun. Because if you don't do that, well, there are 42 states that have the right to keep and bear arms enshrined in their state constitution. From a practical and constitutional standpoint, eradicating the right to keep and bear arms is a non-starter. Unless you just choose to ignore the Second Amendment's protections, which, frankly, some politicians, plenty of politicians, are willing to do. So, based on that metric, right, Armona says, you know, large-scale bans, that's not going to work. For whatever reason, we might disagree on the reasons, but he says, I think we're in agreement that it's not going to work. So, O'Neill writes, the researchers studied how to design a firearm regulation that both improves public health while also minimizing the burden on consumers and manufacturers, which, again, in theory, sounds great, right? Several of these regulations could be seen as neutral or even improvements, O'Neill writes, from the perspective of gun buyers and interest groups like the National Rifle Association, for example. Now, again, I'm very curious about that. So what exactly are we talking about? Well, according to the writer from Harvard, the main policy tool that Armona and Rosenberg focus on is a roughly 10% flat tax on every gun that's sold in the United States, a levy that's been in place since 1918 and is paid when fire manufacturers sell to retailers. He's talking about the 11% excise tax, the Pittman-Robertson Act, which has been in place since the 1930s. I guess earlier than that, but I thought it dated back to the 1930s. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Anyway, that is an existing excise tax, right? So that was their starting point. But O'Neill writes, since different guns have different likelihoods of being used in homicide, handguns are used in 80 to 90% of all homicides in the United States, according to the FBI, the researchers reasoned that it might not just be about taxing all guns at higher or lower rates. When it comes to public health, which guns you tax matter. At least two states, O'Neill writes, California and Colorado have recently approved new taxes on all firearms. California's tax essentially doubles the existing tax to 20%, while Colorado increases the tax to 16.5%. The researchers examined the effects of an approach like California and what it would have if implemented on the national level. They estimate that the tax increase would reduce about 60 firearm deaths a year, and would come at a cost of $400 million and $570 million to firearm consumers and manufacturers, respectively. Moreover, they write, gun owners in Republican states would be harmed the most, which is a feature, not a bug, for the anti-gunners, right? The authors write, given the politically polarized views on firearms regulation in the United States, with Republicans generally supporting lower, laxer policy, this policy is likely to be politically infeasible. I would agree. But let's go back and talk about something for a second. So if the researchers say, if you implemented this, you know, another 11% excise tax, like California has done, nationwide, you would, their estimate, reduce the number of gun-related homicides by 60. Not 60%. You would have 60 fewer homicides across the country at a cost to consumers and manufacturers of almost $1 billion. So what exactly is California's excise tax going to do? How many lives could potentially be saved? How many murders could potentially be stopped at the expense of, on, that's one side of the ledger, right? Then the other question is, how many people are now going to be priced out of exercising their right to keep and bear arms because of California's tax scheme? And not only the tax you pay when you buy a firearm or ammunition, but again, depending on where you live, the $1,000 or more that it might take for you to acquire a carry permit. I'm guessing there are going to be far more than 60 people across the state of California who will throw up their hands and say, it's too expensive for me to do this. Now, again, that wasn't the point of this particular study. But I think it's worth pointing out. So O'Neill, the writer, says, with these real political constraints in mind, the authors considered an alternative taxation scheme that they say does not harm market participants, which in theory would be more politically palatable. Armona says, if you lower taxes on long guns, shotguns and rifles, enough so that you can tax handguns a little more and gun consumers are just as well off, we estimate that you get substantial welfare improvements just by making this small change. They estimated that with this change, you'd have about 40% of the public health benefits of a larger tax on all guns, so 25 fewer firearm deaths per year, as opposed to 60 across the country. And Ramona says, because this policy would be constructed in a way such as consumers are not harmed, it could face significantly less resistance from groups like the NRA or the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which is the industry lobby. I think that is wishful thinking on the part of Ramona. Because while we have the right to keep and bear arms, all guns are not created equal for various purposes, right? You're not going to take a handgun out turkey hunting. And most people would prefer a handgun for self-defense. So if you are, and I agree, handguns are the most common firearm used in crime. They are also the most common firearm used in self-defense. They are, generally speaking, the most commonly owned type of firearm in the country. So it is not, it may at the end of the day on paper be revenue neutral or taxation neutral to raise the taxes on handguns and to lower the taxes on long guns. But that doesn't mean that consumers will not be impacted by that. They very much will be impacted by that. Those consumers who want a firearm for self-defense, who are more likely to choose a handgun for self-defense, are going to face harm from the increased taxes. Right? And now you could argue, well, there's going to be a benefit to folks who want to purchase long guns for self-defense or recreational shooting or any other lawful purpose. And that may be, but that doesn't negate the additional cost to those who would be purchasing handguns, which is why I think it is unreasonable to think that a policy like this would get buy-in from the National Rifle Association or the National Shooting Sports Foundation or any other Second Amendment group, quite frankly. Now, O'Neill writes that Armona sees fertile ground for further study in this area. For example, he says, it's well known that the distribution of gun owners has a long tail. Something like 20% of gun owners own 80% of the stock. Ultimately, he says, what matters from a public health perspective is gun owners, not guns in circulation per se. So for our next project, we plan to use data on gun ownership patterns to better understand how to design buyback programs, how costly it may be to get the, quote, long tail of gun owners to give up their guns, or if it is even worth the cost from a public health perspective. Now, on the surface, that looks like a justification for gun buybacks. I don't think that's actually the case. In fact, when you look at all of the research that's been done on these compensated confiscation programs, none of them have demonstrated a concrete public benefit. In fact, there have been studies that show that violent crime tends to rise after a quote-unquote buyback has been held. So once again, I'm willing to give Armona and Rosenberg the benefit of the doubt. I want to see what that next study looks like. And I do appreciate, to some degree, the stance that they're taking and the approach that they're taking. Because it is different from Moms Demand Action or Giffords or these prohibitionist groups that say, well, the answer is to just get rid of all the guns, right? Even if they don't want to say that publicly, that is the end goal. Gabby Giffords, no more guns, 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 right? And that's not what Armona is saying. But again, there is there's more than one way to address public safety. And to me, fundamentally, if you are trying to address public safety by focusing on people who aren't committing violent crimes, that's a terrible way to go about it. The vast majority of gun owners will never commit a violent offense or a nonviolent offense, but they'll never commit a violent offense with a firearm. We know that most criminals are not legally acquiring their guns. So if you really want to reduce homicides, and by the way, having 25 fewer homicides per year at the expense of $1 billion, there are better ways to reduce homicides by more than that. I'll go back to another project that was actually started in Massachusetts, Operation Ceasefire, which doesn't focus on lawful gun owners, doesn't focus on gun sales, doesn't focus on taxing firearms. It focuses on the people who are committing these violent acts. And the fact that a very small portion of society, maybe as 1% of the population, responsible for as much as 63% of violent crime. That's according to one study. So if you focus your efforts there on that 1%, you can have amazing reductions in violent crime and homicide. And Operation Ceasefire uses a carrot and stick approach. Most of these individuals, well known to law enforcement, they're already involved in the criminal justice system. Most of them are out on probation or parole. So you call them in, and there are two groups of people there. On the one side, you've got law enforcement, right? And it's the local police chief, it's the local DA, it's the U.S. attorney. Maybe you've got somebody from ATF, maybe you've got somebody from DEA. But you've got authority, right? Legal authority. And then there's another group that also represents authority, but community authority, civic authority. So it's the pastors. It's the high school principal. Maybe it's your middle school teacher. It's your parents if they're around. It's violence prevention advocates. And these two groups have the same message. You are going to stop shooting. And we, meaning this group over here, will help you if you let us. But this group over here will make you stop shooting if you don't do it on your own. So if you want to turn your life around, we're going to give you the opportunity to do that. We can get you job training. We can get you counseling. We can help you get your GED. If you've got your high school diploma, we can help you go to college or go to a trade school. We can help you chart a better path in life. But if you don't take advantage of that opportunity, then the next time you get arrested, you're not going to get a plea deal. It's not going to be like what happened in the past. You're not going to get a slap on the wrist. You're not going to be out with, 40 days of time served in jail while you're awaiting trial. We're going to kick your case up to the U.S. Attorney's Office. We're going to prosecute you using whatever federal statute we can. And we're going to put you away for as long as we possibly can because you're killing our community and we're sick of it. So let us help you or we'll put you away. Juvenile homicides in Boston dropped by more than 50% when this program was put in place in the late 1990s. Since then, it has been replicated around the country to great success. It's not a guarantee. I mean, there's a lot of working parts to it. But when you got stakeholders who are on board, when you get the egos out of the way, when you have this multi-agency cooperation, when you've got a commitment to put this plan in place and to stick with it, yeah, homicides can drop by more than 50%. That's a big win. And again, it's not taxing gun owners. It's not looking for a way to find a gun control regulation that gun owners won't object to. It's about focusing on the people who are actually responsible for these crimes. And honestly, that's what I'd love to see Armona and Rosenberg do in the future. But at least we know that there are other ways, far more effective ways, to improve public safety than what they're suggesting. All right, let's turn our attention now to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We will start there with a case out of Sioux Falls, South Dakota, where a man accused of shooting a police officer has a history of firearm thefts. Yeah, actually was paroled after serving two-thirds of his most recent sentence, and he had an active warrant for his arrest at the time. 25-year-old Samir Albadani was wanted by the Sioux Falls Police Department's Violent Crimes Unit as a parole absconder. They found him on April 1st. Authorities say he then shot a police officer during an attempted arrest. He then, according to the police chief there in Sioux Falls, stole a vehicle, fled the scene. Another shootout between Albadani and law enforcement taking place just south of the town of Beresford in Union County, South Dakota. According to South Dakota court records, and the Republic newspaper, Albadani's adult criminal record started in December of 2017. He's 25, so basically from the time he turned 18. He's accused in Lincoln County of felony grand theft of a firearm. He pleaded guilty. What do you get as a first-time offender for stealing a gun? It's a felony offense. He got 20 days in jail. That's it. 2 years probation. While he was on probation, prosecutors and grand juries in Lincoln County and Minnehaha County opened 8 separate criminal cases against him, totaling more than 85 felony and misdemeanor charges, most of which were dismissed in plea deals. But while on probation, he was convicted of 2 additional counts of grand theft of a firearm, 1 count of first-degree burglary, 1 count of simple assault, and 1 probation violation. According to the Department of Corrections, the 5 convictions resulted in a prison sentence of 19 years. But 11 of those years were immediately suspended, so the 19-year sentence becomes an 8-year sentence. So more than half of that sentence just wiped off the books right away. And then of the 8-year sentence, Albadani served about 5 before he was granted parole. So 19 years is what he was sentenced to. He did 5. He did about a quarter of the sentence that he could have and should have received before he was out on parole. In February of last year, a warrant to issue for his arrest after he failed to appear in a courtroom for an eluding charge. That led to the active warrant Albadani being placed on absconder status, meaning that the parole officers were uncertain of his whereabouts, and they were, again, looking for him when they found him, and that shootout took place. According to the Republic newspaper, under South Dakota law, Albadani's past record could enable prosecutors to label him as a habitual offender, which could increase the severity of any potential felony charges. Okay. Great. And what does that mean? He serves 30% of his sentence next time? 40%? You know, South Dakota has great gun laws, but this is an issue that is, and it's not just related to South Dakota. I mean, this is a problem that is endemic within our criminal justice system. We talk a lot about truth in sentencing laws. Yeah. Well, here's an example where there's no truth in that 19-year sentence. And we can go back to that first charge. 20 days in jail for stealing a gun, 2 years probation. I think that's way too light a sentence. But when you are accused and convicted or take a guilty plea to additional crimes when you're out on probation, that to me shows, okay, what we did the first time around didn't work. So the time for leniency is over. And instead, the criminal justice system in South Dakota doubled down on that leniency and gave Albadani the chance to walk out of prison a free man after serving about a quarter of the 19-year sentence that he received. All right, on to today's armed citizen story from Iowa, where a sheriff says an intruder was shot and injured during a break-in in Maquoketa. You know, I know how to pronounce Oklahoma names like Tahlequah and Pottawatomie, but I confess I'm not quite as familiar with Iowa Native American name. So Maquoketa is how I'm going with it. I apologize if you are a resident of this town and I'm butchering the pronunciation, but there you go. Deputies dispatched to a home about 12:15 in the afternoon on April 1st after a 911 call reported an attempted break-in. While deputies were responding, Jackson County Dispatch got a follow-up call indicating that the person trying to break into the home had been shot. When Jackson County deputies arrived, they found an adult male had been shot multiple times. He was taken to a regional hospital for treatment of serious injuries. Iowa Department of Public Safety Division of Criminal Investigation is currently assisting Jackson County in investigating this case. Authorities say there's no ongoing threat to the community. Don't have a lot of details about this. But again, if this individual was trying to break into a home, you have a reasonable belief that they are not there to drop off Girl Scout cookies or to give you your paper. And I suspect that this, again, if all of the evidence continues to point in the this direction, I think this is going to be ruled a justifiable use of force here. But we'll keep our eyes open for more details. Finally today, our good deed of the day in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A group of Good Samaritans in Ohio who came to the aid of an individual who was in really bad shape after a car accident on Interstate 90. That man getting a chance to say thank you and honor those Good Samaritans this week. This was in Concord Township. Their Fire Chief Matthew Sabo talked about extending the deepest gratitude and commendation to these Good Samaritan. Wrong segment here. Ralph Gamber, Meredith Homerick, Sean Labas, Janelle Miskey, Jessica Presley, Megan Dwyer. It was March the 12th. A pickup truck spun out on Interstate 90, ended up rolling over several times. The driver was ejected. The truck landed in the medium and burst into flames. The guy behind the wheel, a man named Mario Tallarico, 65 years old, he is unconscious there in the grassy median. He is very, very close to where his truck is now on fire. And these Good Samaritans, two of whom are nurses, by the way, one of whom is a corrections officer, another owns a tire shop, there's a truck driver, very different backgrounds, but they all reacted the same way. They stopped their cars, they got out of their vehicles, they ran to help Tallarico. They carried him a safe distance away, they started performing first aid. Ralph Gamber said we had a wonderful team. Never knew these people before, but everybody clicked. Everybody wanted to help Mario. Everybody was all in. Everybody was working as fast as they could to get him away from that burning truck. Now, Mario Tallarico doesn't remember the accident. He doesn't remember the aftermath. He said that it was only when he was in the hospital and he was recovering did he start to understand just how lucky he was to be alive and how grateful he was for those Good Samaritans to be there. He is still recovering. He's got a cracked sternum. He's got bruised lungs, broken ribs, but he was there in person in Concord Township this week to say thank you. He said there are no words. He said, I think they were all put there for a reason, man. It's like a team that was put together at that time for a reason. And maybe that is the case. I don't know. Megan Dwyer spoke to a Fox 8 in Cleveland. She said she's so relieved to see how good he's doing, saying he looks amazing. Said, I really wasn't sure the day of the accident how things were going to turn out. So it's really nice to see that he's up and he's with his daughters and his family and he's doing well. You know, so many times we see these stories and these Good Samaritans are never identified. We never see that follow-up. A lot of times we'll see these stories and the person who was saved is looking to find that Good Samaritan. And that doesn't always happen. But I'm glad that Mario Tallarico was able to connect with Ralph Gamber, Meredith Homerich, Sean Labas, Janelle Miskey, Jessica Presley, and Megan Dwyer to say thank you for being in the right place at the right time and willing and able to do the right thing. And that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. I am looking forward to seeing you back here again on Monday. What do you think the odds are we get news from Snope and Ocean State Tactical at the Supreme Court? I mean, we'll get news one way or the other, right? Either we get no word from the court at all or we get some word. Well, either way, we'll be talking about it on Monday. I continue to be cautiously optimistic. I'm like Charlie Brown in the football. This time around, SCOTUS is going to give us what we want. We'll see. But in the meantime, have a great rest of your week, a fantastic weekend. We'll see you back here soon. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.